Blog Talk Radio.
This is Paula Thompson coming to you from Westminster, Colorado. That was the beautiful voice of Francel Garwin. You can find more of Francel's music at francel.com. And with me is my dear friend from Boulder, Krystalyn Beek Larson. Hi, Krystalyn.
Good morning. What a beautiful day.
Nice to have you. It is. It's a beautiful day. We're approaching the end of summer and the beginning of fall, and weather's cooling down, so I hope it's cooler and nicer where you are, wherever that may be, to all of our listeners. It's I know it's been pretty hot in certain parts of the world, and certainly in the south in Texas, so our hearts go out to you guys, and they're getting dumped on in the northeast again, and our hearts go out to them. Some of our friends up there are in flood zones, so our prayers are with you guys. And we're doing the fourth in our series on education. We have had three so far wonderful guests. Today is a call-in show. We've got several guests lined up to call in, educators and people with experience in homeschooling and early childhood education, special education, daycare, so some real experts in the field of young child and young children and young children's education. And we know that there are some people out there that are interested in homeschooling, so we hope you tune in and get a chance to listen to this show. And speaking of your young children, I have my grandson here with me. So that's Andy. Ask your Aunt Maymay, okay? Please? Okay, ask Aunt Maymay.
But I saw him. We just talked.
great way to start the show on early childhood development.
They get their needs met. That's the thing about children. So with us right now, we have two callers on. And Barbara West from Canada. Barbara, yeah. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. I'm glad you called in.
Thanks for joining us. I'm so happy to have you on the program today.
Oh, great. I'm glad to be here.
And Barbara, you have an expertise in early childhood education. And
yeah, I graduated from the University of Alberta in Canada in 1974 with a Bachelor of Education in Special Education and Child Development.
Wonderful.
And then I continued in early childhood and lifespan development. So I'm over 60 now and retired, and I've had lots of experience, and my passion is definitely young children, teaching reading, but also teaching communication skills. and raising my own 2 children.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And I'm also interested in the lifespan development theories and or topic. Can you share a little bit about what that entails?
Well, it's the lifespan begins before birth and ends at death on this world, mm-hmm. and that's what that study would be about. And they kind of divide it up into social, emotional, intellectual, and physical development of each stage. It's very interesting because it used to just be that we were children and then we were adults. And now we know that there's prenatal, there's infancy, there's toddlers, preschool. And even at the other end, we now have... We have the old, we have the oldest old, older old, we have the oldest old, we have the robust old. So all of these categories have their own social, emotional, physical, and intellectual development research studies going on. So it's really an interesting field, big
wow.
field. Always a bigger picture.
And also we have with us Sarah Livingston. Is that it, Sarah?
The last name is Lancaster.
Lancaster, okay, sorry, I
That's
apologize.
Okay.
Sarah has been homeschooling, and I might mention that Barbara has been reading the Urantia book for many, many years, probably close to 40, right, Barbara?
Uh-huh,
and,
yes.
And Sarah has just started reading and has been reading for about a year the Urantia book, so it's going to be interesting to have both of those perspectives, I think. And also Sarah's perspective on homeschooling and your experience with that, which is really a popular, it's getting more and more popular now as a method of teaching young children. So
it really
is. So maybe
welcome
you can tell
us. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you very much.
We really appreciate
your calling in. Tell us a little about your background.
I look forward to it.
And can you give us some background about your experience, Sarah?
Yes, I have a 10-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter, and I have been homeschooling just since my son, you know, entered kindergarten. We were traveling as a family at the time, and so I'd always wanted to homeschool anyway, but it was very appropriate, and so I naturally just did that, and I have stuck with it. And I have been brought up in Christian fundamentalism and Messianic Judaism, and have just found the Urantia book last summer and really did about 6 months of fairly intensive studying of the book, and the last 6 months have just been a little more free form and just kind of taking it all in. But I've really just found the teachings to be profound, and being a homeschooling mom, I really am now searching for ways. Of course, we're right into a new school year, and I'm very interested in finding ways to incorporate the teachings into even the core subjects of the school. So I'm really interested to hear what the more seasoned educators and Urantia book readers have to say on this topic. So I'm very thankful that Crystalyn invited me to be part of this.
Well, I'm really excited to have you with us because you've had such a rich and diverse background from a lot of the guests we've had on the program previously,
mm-hmm.
with being part of, what I would say an alternative education program for your own kids as well as yourself. You had an interesting childhood.
Yes, I did.
I don't know if you care to share any of that with our listeners, but it seems like it has an influence on the direction and lifestyle you're choosing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, my parents were, on one hand, very fundamentalist Christian. They were very Bible-believing, and they taught their children to seek God, you know, first from the heart, which I really love that, and and they taught us to, you know, to read the Bible for ourselves and those things. So they were very fundamentalist, biblical in one way, and in another way they were very free-form people, and they, you know, I think that mix kind of has allowed me to do my own spiritual seeking as an adult. And they did homeschool and did approve of homeschooling when I was a child. They homeschooled for just a couple of years. So that was really, you know, easy for me to kind of want to go into that. And it, for me, it has been really just a natural urge to want to homeschool my children, looking at the social climate of our communities and the quality or the lack of quality of a lot of the schooling systems. It's just been a natural inclination of mine to want to homeschool. So, but I am, you know, young and I am fairly new at it, and so any input is really wonderful.
Well, okay, I have a question for Barbara then. Barbara, you have taught in the Canadian school system for most of your career?
Yes, I have. And actually at all levels. I was trained as in early childhood and special education, but I ended up in the college teaching teachers, so I've had adults as well.
Right. And what would you do? Are you real familiar with, you know, Sarah mentions the social situation in the public schools, which I think a lot of people are concerned with. Do you think that that's really as big an issue in Canada as it might be in America, in the United States, I mean?
I do think it's an issue, and certainly in the 70s and 80s, there was quite a backlash for the schools, actually from the fundamentalist Christians, who did not want the schools approaching morality at all. And there were a number of really neat programs to, I guess my belief is that we can't go on the chance factor that these morals are, the children are being guided at home, and so I feel very strongly about it being in the school system. And there was a backlash. And I just have this one quote from the Urantia book. It's under the maintenance of civilization. And just part of it says, neither has the modern appreciation of ethics, so that's our set of principles and values, neither has the modern appreciation of ethics developed in correspondence with the growth along the more purely intellectual and scientific lines. And modern civilization is at a standstill in spiritual development and the safeguarding of the home institution. So certainly I believe that reading is important. We need to, as Charles was saying, how important that is for literacy. But what's not kept up is that appreciation, the ethical development in schools. And I see that window of opportunity up till, you know, sometimes 8 to 10 years old, that if those kids are not getting guidance in those areas, the window shuts and we end up with bigger problems. So, yes, there has been a backlash in Canada about looking at morals in schools.
Barb,
that was your question, wasn't it? Yes.
Barb, I would like to comment on that as a homeschooling mom. I would say that that has been one of the greatest benefits and joys thus far in schooling my son, especially because he is older and I've had much more time with him, has been to be able to have that ethical and moral and spiritual education opportunity with him. It's just been something that I have valued so much, and we've had so many conversations. And, of course, they've never usually been in the context of, you know, the regimented type sit-down and learn a topic schooling. But I've had the opportunity to just take any moment during the day, any chance happening, and sit down. And we've had discussions that would last an hour, maybe more. And it's something that I know that he'll take into the rest of his life, and it's just something that has been so valuable to me, you know. So I agree with that.
Yeah, that's very exciting, isn't it? Yes, and I guess I think that I didn't home my school my children, and I'm a teacher. I was very involved in their education. Mm-hmm. I was often in the schools, which, you know, we're very welcome in the schools in Canada, but traditionally, when we were going to school, the doors were pretty much shut. Our parents never came in. And even today you see parents gathering out at, you know, the outside the doors waiting for the kids to come out, and they, it's very difficult even for me, knowing that I could go in the schools, to go in there and sit in the classrooms and be part of the learning, so that I knew what my kids were doing, and then we would have those discussions when we got home with the topics that they were encountering at school.
Well, it's interesting to me that there are opportunities perhaps for somebody homeschooling that wouldn't occur in a school because of these issues about mentioning morals and even religion, and the opportunity to sit down and, you know, a teachable moment where obviously this is a great place to insert God and a universe reality into this moment, and let's discuss the, you know, the morals or the ethics of this moment. And so that would be, I can see how that's a drawback with public education. On the other hand, I can also see that perhaps there are drawbacks with homeschooling that public education really provides that homeschooling doesn't. What do you think some of those might be, Barbara?
Well, I think that we need to be working with the masses, so to speak. That's I wanted my children with other children, and homeschooling now has gotten bigger where they do join up with others. But I think the schools have a lot to offer, as I think the churches have a lot to offer our children, because they're areas where they're venues where they are talking about values. And then my children were with other children that had those belief systems. In the schools, certainly each teacher has a lot of autonomy in the classroom, meaning they can pretty much do what they want. And as we know, and you said, Sarah, earlier, I think you said it, it's the way you teach. It's not always necessarily what you teach. And so if I was aware of what was going on in the school and I had communication with the teacher, an easy communication, not a communication of what are you doing wrong, what are you doing to my kid, but hey, what's going on, how's it going, what was your day like? You know, we began to have fellowship with each other, which is really key to living, is that fellowship of living as well as the fellowship of worship. So I appreciated that my kids were in school. They didn't always have the best experience, but I was always aware of it, and we were able to bring it home and talk about tolerance at home, whatever that topic was. There is a lot of extra time after school to be with your kids too. So my kids have friends in all walks of life, and that was a huge learning thing, was to be non-judgmental, to be accepting of quick learners, of slow learners, of different faiths, of different backgrounds, kids that had bad behavior. All of that was there for them to encounter, and then we could work with it.
Now, one of the things that you said is that your experience was that individual teachers had quite a bit of leeway in the classroom. I'm not sure that that's true, perhaps, in all schools or in all parts of the country and in different countries. Teachers have perhaps more constraints on what they can and can't do in the classroom. Do you think that's true in Canada as well, or do you think that Canadian teachers have more flexibility or more can make more of these decisions individually?
In my experience, the teachers, you know, depending on the venue, I expect in other countries where there's maybe a, you know, really large classes and there's a lot of, I'm not even sure of what happens. But anyway, in Canadian schools, in my experience, the venue's really been in a classroom where your door's shut and you've got your 30 children, I mean really 20 to 40 children in a classroom, and for elementary school. And what you say and what you do and how you perform and how you model to the children the way you are with different behaviors in the classroom, the children are all vulnerable to that adult that's in the classroom.
Yeah.
You're mm-hmm. there. If you yell at one child, every child in the room will feel that they could be yelled at or whatever the behavior is. So
right.
really, in a classroom, the teacher has, when I say autonomy, I guess it's power too. It will be, she will be modeling day after day after day after day to your children, or he.
Yeah.
And that's why it's mm-hmm. so good to have a rapport with your classroom teacher as a person. And I just want to mention, Charles said something last week about schools consist of relationships between persons. Everything else is secondary. So, you know, again, that was part of my desire to have my children relating to other people, because they would come home with really wild stories about maybe even the teacher-child relationship, but we could talk about it. I couldn't change what was going on, but I could change the environment for my children and talk about it, change their attitude maybe towards someone's behavior. Again, that thing about there's always a bigger picture, my kids refrain that all the time, every time they meet anybody, that you need to know you can't make these judgments about people or assumptions. Those are fabulous things that I've instilled in my kids, I think, or that they have developed with myself and community involved, certainly, and their teachers.
I think you hit on such an important point in mentioning what Charles said. I just want to point out that Charles also said that that he felt like he was sovereign in his classroom. So I think that's
mm-hmm.
knowing that he came from three different and taught in three different states in the United States and felt like he was sovereign in his classroom, which is an interesting point. But I think that Sarah, you know, you would probably and most homeschooling parents would say this, and I think that the issue a lot of times is this issue of influence, and you touched on it, Barbara, because the teacher is the most influential person in the classroom, and in a sense, you're taking your precious little child. It's the most, it's the ultimate act of trust and faith
yes.
for a parent to take this beautiful little soul that they've brought into the world and to put them down 100% in the care of somebody they don't know at all,
mm-hmm.
and to trust that these people are professionals. They're going to be kind to that child, tolerant of that child, sensitive to that child's needs, but also, and I mean, it gives a sense of what we expect of teachers, especially public school teachers, to be sensitive to every
mm-hmm.
other needs in that room, as well as how they all interact together, to be a fair arbiter in case
mm-hmm.
of things, you know, come up, and to be a psychologist if that child is troubled that day, or to be a nurse if that child falls down and hurts itself, or all of those things that a parent would do, a teacher is expected to do. But then you add in the extra element of the influence that other children have over that child. So it's really a matter, at least to me, of influence, because we know that, you know, a lot of people want to blame parents for everything that goes wrong in a child's life, but parents are not the only influence in a child's life. There's clergy, and there's coaches, and there's teachers,
mm-hmm.
you know, maybe scout leaders or whatever, and especially peers. I think peers are that great lifelong influence. I noticed that when my mom was elderly, she was still more influenced by her own peers than anybody else.
Uh-huh.
So.
Yes.
You know, and here's a teacher thrown into this mix, and I fully understand why parents want to kind of homeschool their children or take them out of what might be seem to them to be chaotic. Sarah, how do you feel about that? I mean, what were your motivations for wanting to homeschool more than anything else?
Okay. You know, I think that when I make commitments in life, my personality is to just commit 100% to what I'm doing. I feel that way firstly about my marriage, well, firstly about my relationship with the father, but secondarily about my relationship with my husband. And so it's been very automatic for me from the moment I found out I was pregnant with my son to give him that same full commitment. So my first motivation is not about, preventing my children from social situations. It's my first motivation is because I feel that they are maybe my most important work at this point in my life, especially as, a human. I consider them to be just of utmost importance. And I believe that as a parent, you know your children better than anyone else. You know, the intimacy and the closeness, and, you know, you've been the one to hold them in the night. And, you know, if you're a mother, you've nursed them and you've seen everything that they've been through. And for me, I just never reached a point when they became, quote, school age, where I felt like, okay, I'm done with my work and I'm ready to pass them on. You know, I've, especially through their younger years, felt that it was entirely appropriate for me to be their educator, their nurturer, and perform all of those functions of spiritual educator and emotional educator and psychologist and nurse, like you were saying. Now, I will say that one of the drawbacks, and a lot of people, I'll say this too, a lot of people, especially in the Christian community that I am aware of, they do, and at least they have, and I don't think it is quite as common, but they have had the motivation of wanting to hide their children's, you know, eyes from the world and that sort of desire to have them, you know, kind of unaware of some of the, quote, horrible things going on. But
and would you say that that's they really want to protect them from the value system that they believe is being instilled in secular education?
I think so. I think a lot of the Christian parents, anyway, have done it for that. You know, have done it for that reason. I see that there are a lot of secular people are starting to homeschool though too, and of course, I don't think that that's their motivation. It's more that they just see the quality of the school being poor. But one thing I have noticed that I would say is a drawback to homeschooling is the lack of socialization. And that's one reason a lot of public schoolers will say right off the bat, oh, it's not healthy, they're not being socialized. And I would say that there's, you know, two sides to that coin. I have been aware that my children have been very healthy socially through the younger years, just, you know, me raising them, and then, of course, when I take them out into the world and they are social, they do very, very well. But I will say that as my son is coming up through 8 years and nine, and now he's 10, going on 11, he has begun to request socialization. And I am very aware of the changes that he goes through, and I'm very responsive to those because I feel as though the cues that he's giving me are what he needs, and I do pay attention to that. And I think that there comes a point during that pre-adolescence, I would say after 8 years old, I would kind of draw a line there just from my experience with my one child, which isn't a very broad experience, but it's my own. It's what I do, you know, feel like I know, that after that age, there does need to be a lot of socialization. You know, I think the universe is a social place. I think our entire life scope, our eternal life scope is a social matter. And it is very important that children are socialized and that, like Barbara said, that they encounter many different things, even strange things, you know, and are able to be taught about those things. So I think that, you know, kind of at that age, it really becomes important. And so that's something that I'm really working with my son to try to provide those social situations now. And I think that that will increase throughout his whole adolescence and teenage years, you know.
I'd like to interject something here too, just from a personal observation and my personal experience. Just what you were just talking about something changing around the age of eight, and obviously it's going to be different for each child. But if we're going to sort of make a generalization, some of our listeners know that, you know, I was raised overseas in in post-colonial Africa, and that for us, what was the norm for schooling was that we left to go off to boarding school at school age. And from my own personal experience was that, you know, I left home when I was almost seven. And I've raised both a stepdaughter and been intimately involved with my brother's children, and have noticed, you know, there's certain developmental stages where it seems really clear that that's like too young to be separated for long periods of time from your parents. And my own experience was that, you know, prior to seven, I was really too young to be leaving home, not just for the day, but especially for months at a time. And there was something that happened after the age of eight that made that experience much easier, a completely different type of experience. Mm. And so I think that, you know, one of the things that Jesus says to Ganad in the Urantia book, or not to Ganad, to John Mark in his discussions about parenting, is that, you know, the first 8 years of a child's development can influence them practically for the entire afterlife.
That's interesting.
It does. Yes.
I have to say that's interesting, being a new Urantia reader. I'm not, of course, familiar with all of those marks, but it's interesting that that age is mentioned, and, you know, my own personal experience has been that that was kind of the age when my son, I started noticing, it was even just something in his eyes. I could tell that he wanted to look out into the world. He was ready to go and now see what more there is. You know, it's just interesting to me.
Well, maybe. Could I just add to that?
Yeah.
About
yeah.
the community? So somewhere in that age, again, I mean, 8 to 12 years old, 10 to 12 years old, I understand that it's important to bridge the community with your children. So for my son, for instance, to have other male mentors in his life than the home, for my daughter to have other female mentors in the community, like, and I got to choose those. I mean, I was choosing those people. It might have been a coach, it might have been a friend of mine or whatever, where they were beginning to spend time out in the world with other adult mentors of my choosing other than teachers. And I think that's really important to do. Anyway, I'll let you continue. I have a few other things that from your, Sarah, I really appreciate your enthusiasm. And I think that's with my kids in public school and befriending those teachers each year in some way or getting to know them ahead of time, what I was able to do was share my enthusiasm for my children's education.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in that way, I was able to have this rapport with the teacher, regardless of, sometimes you don't have a choice with in public school systems, of in small towns particularly, of who your teacher is going to be. And
right.
I've had parents come to me and say, you know, my son's teacher is not working, and I can't
right.
change him.
Right.
And so then the brainstorming becomes, okay, so for your son, he's telling you this, you're experiencing this, how can you work with this? What's a way that, let's just brainstorm some ideas of your son's going to meet weird people in life, bad people, good people in life. So here he is in grade three learning some of this lesson here. And I mean, that's just
and some
another
of them are
part
that Sarah, some of them are painful.
Yes, and we have to work with them, and we have to somehow learn to see, to build on their strengths too, and uplift those people that are out to lunch or whatever. The other thing about the homeschooling, I really appreciate homeschoolers, and what I understand with my kids in school and from homeschoolers is how important it is to plan for friendships, to teach. Some kids need actual direct teaching in how to make friends, how to keep friends.
Mm.
Like, what are those? And so my children in public school coming home with a story about how a teacher was mean to a child or whatever, what we would end up discussing was, well, what can you do for Timmy? You know, how can you we can't change maybe that teacher, but we can change Timmy's environment by how could you be a friend with Timmy? Mm-hmm. And in one situation, my son is still friends with that particular little boy. Not friends, but they see each other, and they really appreciate each other for different reasons. So
well,
yeah,
and
building
I think
friendships,
one of,
planning for friendships.
And one of the things that you had written in one of your emails to me, Barbara, is that this is outside of sort of the homeschooling topic, but just that we never really can know what kind of home environment kids are in, what they're being taught in the home in terms of values and ethics. It's not just what's taught in the schools, but, you know, we don't really have any kind of parental training schools or family training programs yet on our world that are really cradle to grave types of life. That's why I was interested in the term you used at the beginning of the show, you know, lifespan development. Because we don't know what kinds of things kids are being taught even in the home, there's some communication skills that you said you were able to bring into your classrooms about feeling and listening and observing. Maybe you could share a little bit about that with our listeners.
Well, I think, you know, having read the Urantia book and that last section about Jesus, his life, excuse me, he modeled really observing and understanding and loving others.
Mm.
And so my, you know, coming from a teacher's point of view, too, and not a, I mean, I am a parent, but I didn't homeschool my kids. So I certainly am I'm an advocate for schools and providing environments that work for children, for individuals to really experience their own majestic personality, to understand and experience that, and to have techniques to uplift others. So that's been my whole emphasis in teaching every age group. So Jesus showed us what to do. So when you peel the onion, so to speak, what are those things that we need to teach? We need to teach compassion, cooperating, perspective taking, for instance, understanding what it's like to be in someone else's shoes. We can't go on the chance factor that kids are learning that at home. So perspective taking, I mean, it's interesting in the research that perpetrators of crime often don't have perspective taking skills. So they don't have that ability to put themselves in someone else's shoes. They don't feel remorse then.
Can you give us
an example of that?
Concrete examples of that? Yeah.
Of perspective taking?
Right.
Well, for young children, what parents probably, I don't want to say good parents, but a lot of parents who speak to their children will say, oh, look at that. That little girl is sad because she's crying. That woman looks upset. She's dropped her bag of groceries. So you're just pointing it out. You're giving children the opportunities to see and understand others' feelings. If you're not ever getting those opportunities, you can't feel what it might be like. Like you might say, what do you think that little girl feels like? Why do you think she feels like that?
Mm.
You know, what's happening? You pointed out, even with the, I think that dog is angry, the hair is standing up on end, you know, like what's going on here? So we point that out. If parents don't talk to their kids, if they're not communicating to their kids, they simply aren't getting the opportunities for that. And when we talk about that age of eight, perspective taking, understanding what it's like to be in someone else's shoes is a very abstract concept. That window of opportunity ends at about 8 or 10 years old.
Wow.
So it's really, really important to give kids the opportunity to understand others. And Jesus loved that. He modeled that. So how can we do that My belief is that, even as Charles said, that this idea of relationships between people is everything else is secondary. It is the curriculum. We need to teach reading, but we need to teach how to talk to others, how to understand that we all have thoughts and feelings, that some of our thoughts and feelings are the same as others, and it's okay to have that. It's okay to have different thoughts and feelings.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone experiences all of the emotions, but in their own way. It's okay to be themselves. And to develop that feeling vocabulary and articulate their thoughts and feelings verbally, how can they learn to listen? So the example that I have, part of it I learned from Marvin Garwin's book, The Family Meeting Book, many years ago. We always had family meetings at our home weekly. We still do, and I only have one of my children living with me, but we still have our weekly family meetings. Whoever is in the house joins.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, they're very simple rules. Everyone gets a turn. You can skip your turn if you want. The person who's talking gets listened to. There's no put-downs and no interrupting. So we can explore what a put-down is by, you know, anything that makes someone feel bad. Well, what are those, you know? So you can do that with any age group. You can do that with adults in your family meeting, with young children. You can develop it with a topic. And I believe so strongly in direct teaching children, not just my own, but others, because I had that opportunity, how to talk to each other, how to listen, how to reflect what you hear, how to feel good about your thoughts and feelings, and that it's okay that others think differently than you, that they take a different perspective, how to understand the feelings of others. So that's one methodology, and I certainly use that.
And that's
from
just
my teaching education.
So important in ongoing relationship life skills. I remember when I was a teenager, my parents both being involved in, you know, sort of personal development and self-actualization courses and things, where you'd have groups of adults that were learning how to listen to one another, as if this was sort of a really new idea.
Right.
And I remember thinking that this was, at the time, I remember thinking, you know, being a teenager, quite judgmentally, you know, man, what's with all these old people who don't know how to listen to each other, you know. But I remember that part of it was they were learning to feedback what they had heard.
Right. Active listening,
right. And, you know, you think about just how unprepared for social skills even large percentages of population groups are, who just have never been taught how to do these things. And how one of the things that's I think really unique about what the Urantia book teaches is that relationships are ends in and of themselves, and that they are eternal things. They're living eternal essences that
mm-hmm.
we get, you know, one of the things we get to take with us from this life are our relationships. And so of all of the things to invest in our lifetime, relationships are really worth it. I mean, they're really worth putting in the effort and doing the best we can to learn how to do them well.
I'd like to share a little story here because of just what you guys are saying and you know how important it is, obviously, to teach these things so that you, especially empathy. I think empathy, being able to put yourself in the other person's shoes, is just vital in life. Mm-hmm. And reading is more than just reading on a page. Reading is reading what's going on with a person, reading their body language, reading what they're putting out, even if they say nothing. And those skills can be honed, and children can, as you pointed out, learn to be sensitive to that and understanding of it. And years ago, I was at a Urantia conference in France, and I was having lunch. We were on our lunch break, and I was sitting next to Renee Vanderpool. And Renee has been an elementary school teacher in British Columbia for years and years. And she's also retired, Barbara. I don't know if you've ever met her, but it was just the most delightful lunch and something I'll never forget. And I asked her, because right at the time Columbine had happened, that's in our state, and it hurt us all very badly. It was the worst high school massacre in history. It was shocking. It was sobering. It you know,
started this.
Yeah, just, you know, why are there bullies? What happens? And I personally think that those two young men were as much victims as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it gives me, you know, it was just really on my heart and on my mind. And I asked Renee, I said, how do you, I said, you know, I know it's difficult and you're under constraints as to what you can teach, but have you found ways to teach spiritual concepts to your third graders? And she said, well, yes, I have. I've developed some really wonderful exercises over the years. And I said, well, give me an example of one. And she said, well, one of them I do every year, every new class of third graders. I do it early on in the year. She said, they'll go out for lunch, and while I'm inside, I'll set up a puzzle. And a jigsaw puzzle, you know, not a lot of pieces, and I have it already pretty much set up, but I always will take out one piece and put it in my pocket. And I'll put it in somewhere that's very, very visible in the classroom where they all have to walk by it as they come back in. And she said they'll all walk by the puzzle and they'll study it for, you know, however long, a minute or so, and then they'll come over to me and say, Ms. Vanderpool, there's a piece missing from that puzzle. And she said, it really troubles them. It really troubles them that there's a piece missing. And she'll say, okay, you know, and maybe when all the children come in, we'll discuss this. And so when they all come in and after they've all had a chance to look at it, then they all gather around the puzzle. And she said, I'll ask them, isn't this a nice puzzle? And they'll, you know, kind of sheepishly say yes and agree, but she says, then I'll say to them, but what's wrong with this puzzle? And she said, hands will just shoot up, and I'll call on one of the children and say, what is wrong with it? Well, there's a piece missing, and there's like a collective, you know, agreement or, you know, sigh of relief that, well, this is obvious, there's a piece missing. And she said, at that moment, I'll pull the piece out of my pocket and show it to them. And they're all relieved to know that the piece is not gone or lost. And she said, now, this is the piece, isn't it? And she said, I'll tell them, now, look at it very carefully. By itself, it doesn't seem to make much sense, does it? Away from the puzzle, it just is, it has an odd shape and different colors, and outside of the puzzle, it just doesn't seem to make sense. But when we put it in the puzzle, and she said at that moment she puts it in, it makes total sense. And she said they're all, you could just feel their relief. The moment she completes the puzzle, they're relieved. And there's like a collective sigh of relief. Oh, there's the puzzle. It's complete now. And she tells them, each one of you is like this puzzle piece. Each one is different. Each one is unique. Some are big, some are small, some are tall, some are short. Some are Asian, some are white. Doesn't matter. This classroom is like the puzzle. And when one of you is missing, the puzzle's not complete. And it's because each of you matter. Each of you are vital to the completion of the puzzle. And it's such a simple concept. But she told me that every single child in that classroom totally gets it.
Uh-huh.
And totally understands after that point the value of their place And they start to think of each other in that sense, in that sense of value, from that value perspective. And she said they get it so well that when she will hire, like, attendance monitors or appoint attendance monitors for the day, they'll run with it and they'll come up and tell her, today, Ms. Vanderpool, there are three pieces of the puzzle missing when children are absent, you know, because they totally get the concept. And I was so touched by that, you know, that very simple little exercise. But she told me, after that, the whole year will go better.
Mm-hmm.
Because the children in the class, and this is, again, eight-year-olds or third graders, I guess that's eight or nine, totally get the concept and will be more respectful and empathetic of every other child in that room because of that simple exercise.
Could I just add to that?
Yeah.
I agree with that totally, and I really emphasize that these kinds of things need to be, something needs to be brought up daily. It takes 21 days to form a habit, and so we need to be putting this in a program on a daily basis. I mean, that's a great way to start the year, but then what I was talking about was a talking circle, 15 minutes. With a group of 12 to 15 kids, where they begin to practice these techniques, their techniques. I was reading under Ethical Awakening on page 597, it says, only moral beings will ever seek for that spiritual insight, which is essential to living the golden rule. The golden rule being like unselfish devotion to the welfare of others. So they need to begin to understand so many others, like you said in that story. And Jesus said that the golden rule demands active social contact.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding how to articulate in thoughts and feelings at an early age, because that's when you kind of get it, you know, you can move that into your life. And the children's father told them a lot of Jesus stories from the Urantia book about teamwork, about compassion for people, you know, stories like his discussions with John Mark and Ganad, listening to others, how he loved to observe people. Having then the vocabulary already to express and articulate your thoughts and feelings, then you can become friends with Jesus and articulate your thoughts and feelings with him, right? Like it all meshes together. So I think it's really, really important to do this on a daily basis and put it so it becomes habit with children. And because I had the opportunity to work with others' children or even have parents come in and help, because you can't do it with 30 kids. You need to do it with 10 or 12 kids so that you can train parents. You know, it's becoming habit. It's becoming more than the direct teaching. It's giving the opportunity over and over and over again. It's like sensory integration with children. They either get it or they don't by the time they're about 10. So, and it's not teaching a specific skill. It's giving them opportunities to balance, to push toys, to pick up things, to cross their midline. It's just giving them the opportunities so that they do it. So you can't just sit there and do nothing.
Right.
You need to be active in forming habits.
One of the other things the Urantia book is really clear about is that children learn by doing.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they're naturally active, energetic little creatures, and they are very, they're just sponges, you know, they're naturally information sponges, and that, you know, learning really should be a natural and a realistic experience, as opposed to a contrived or a hypothetical or experience, some way that they learn secondhand. You know, Urantia book talks about, you know, academic learning as being something that should happen
later in education.
Uh-huh.
You know, that really we've sort of been doing things backwards, and that we need to think about teaching youth or teaching children life skills before we really focus in so much on academics. And
uh-huh.
that's really different from the way our, at least our Western school system, but I think pretty much across the world, the way we've been doing education has been, you know, sitting in a classroom listening to a teacher until more recently. What do you think about those inferences in the Urantia book?
Oh, I think you're right on the mark. I learned from actually a woman who worked with the Margaret Mead School, and that was one of my models that I used in teaching. She came up and gave a speech in Banff, and we brought her home, and she talked a lot. And she, those kids who were going to learn to read were going to learn to read, but she talked about reading rich literature to the children, you know, from a very early age, so they began to hear the rhythm of the language, the rhythm of our language, be it German or English or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
that learning to talk to each other, exploring through art, music, drama, all the other areas, being the, like, my opportunity to work in early childhood services was a 0 to 8 model, which was perfect. Like, it was sort of like grade 3 area, and a lot of kids did learn to read, and a lot of kids learned to read by creating their own stories and using those words, their words. They would learn words like hippopotamus or appreciate, where
right.
that's not really taught in school, but they understood the rhythm of really good literature. That was the rhythm of our language. That's a rhythm. The Urantia book, reading the Urantia book sets a rhythm in my life because of the way the language is set up. It's got a rhythm to it. It's a music. And so what you're saying, I totally agree with. Not just sit in desk and learn how, yes, we want literacy, but we've all said it. Charles said it. The schools consist of relationships between person. Everything else is secondary. We need to know.
And relationship with nature,
others.
Too.
And with nature, yes. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, Jesus spent so much time outdoors and studying nature during his early years with his father and with his mother and the whole family spending time in the garden using the Edenic model of the whole family as gardeners, you know.
Studying the flowers, studying the scars.
Studying flowers and plants and growing food and you know, studying the little creatures and just the kinds of things that children naturally are interested in when they're young. I mean, I was also really lucky to be outdoors most of the time when I was a little kid, in a very verdant, lush, tropical rainforest surrounding where there was just so much natural activity, just literally buzzing around all the time. And, you know, I grew up being really fascinated with bugs. And
oh, me too.
You
yeah,
know, just,
would love my daughter. She's
connection. Wow,
she's beyond fascinated with the little creatures.
Fabulous.
She is a little. I call her my little Bendy Irwin. She, you know, who is it? Steve Irwin, the crocodile guy that passed away. His little daughter is just like him.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
my daughter is a lot like her, but she's just, I mean, if she's outside, she has a little lizard in her hand constantly.
Cool.
Or two or three in a little box or something. And but that's something that I've really thought is important for education and something I've incorporated with my kids.
And you live on an organic farm also.
It's simple, it's small, and you know, often the garden is half weeds because of so much of what I do with the kids and the house chores and all of that. But yes, we try to. We have 4 acres, and we keep. I have 2 goats, which are for milk. We have 12 chickens, which are for eggs, and we have had several gardens. This past year has been our best garden, and you know those things to me. It's again, it's part of their education. I do those things mostly because I feel that it's something that my children need to understand. Where do things come from? Where does food come from? Everything in our culture feels so detached from home and reality for our children. They just, things just arrive at Walmart and you go and buy them and they have no idea what went into that, you know. And so I guess I'm doing a little bit of that to give them some sense of reality and responsibility and understanding of the natural process, you know.
I have a question that might be kind of out from left field, but how do your kids respond to eating vegetables if they're growing them themselves? I don't know
they
how
seem
many
to really
other
enjoy
families
that.
Have that issue.
They seem to really enjoy that. Of course, the neighbor kids come over, and they just don't really like my kitchen, and I'm troubled by that because I'm trying to create foods that are kid-friendly, and my children have learned to eat. And we don't eat exclusively health food. We certainly don't. But, you know, I use a lot of healthier ingredients and things like that. But the children love eating. For instance, we had sugar snap peas early in the spring, and one morning we went out to the garden and we picked the sugar snap peas and put them in a stainless steel pan. And I don't think a single pea made it back in the house. You know, and we just sat there in the morning light and kind of squatted down in the garden. There weren't really chairs, so squatted down, and they just demolished these fresh organic right off the stem, you know, just right off the plant. And they love it, and they love bringing in the things from the garden. They'll bring me a cantaloupe, and they say, "Are we having that cantaloupe for breakfast?" And my son takes care of the chickens, and he brings in the eggs, and he looks after them. And they love to, oh, it's so exciting when they see a chicken actually lay an egg and these sorts of things, you know. And they're fascinated by it. They are just fascinated by it. And they love being so close to the process, the children, the neighbors, you know, watching me milk a goat. And, oh, that's where milk comes from. And it's so fascinating to them. You know, these are things that kids now aren't exposed to. They don't know where these things come from, you know.
What a wonderful
opportunity
to provide your children. And, you know, something occurs to me, and as I've been listening to both Sarah and Barbara, Sarah, you're a professional educator, or Barbara, you're a professional educator, and I know many professional educators have to remain themselves educated and be up on you know, lots of different techniques for schooling. And so, Sarah, my hat's off to you for taking on that responsibility in your children's lives. And I think, Barbara, you could attest better than anybody that is a full-time job in itself to teach children and, you know, to take that responsibility and to be a teacher for your children. Probably I'm assuming that gives you tremendous respect for teachers who do that for many children every day.
Oh, absolutely. We have started to take the children. One thing that I miss at home is my husband and I, neither of us were educated musically. We could have been. We have the ability. So some of the things that are missing from the homeschool environment, unless, of course, the parents themselves possess those abilities, are the fine arts. And I've started taking my children to fine arts classes on Fridays. There's a wonderful local organization, the Home of Fine Arts, and they have all sorts of music and art and dance and these things. And it's our first year going there, but they have professional teachers, and many of them were in the public school system. And because I have a preschool-aged child, some of these teachers of the preschool-aged children will ask for parents to attend the classes. And there is one in particular, my daughter's preschool music, where I'm the only parent that has volunteered or has ever stayed in the room. And I'm so used to doing that with my children that it's nothing to me to sit in on my daughter's classes. I mean, at least I'm not doing the teaching. I feel like I'm getting a break even though I'm still sitting there. But I can see her gratefulness, you know, because I'm the only one who's, you know, I'm really just there to take the little ones to potty break when they have to go so that she doesn't have to break up the entire class. But the appreciation I see in the teachers' eyes and in their, you know, you can just really pick up on the appreciation they have when a parent participates, and you can see almost a hunger for it. So I think that that's really important, and certainly, Barbara, you would understand that. I think there needs to be a lot more connection between the parents and the teachers, and I do totally applaud the teachers. They're, at least in the United States, they're not getting paid well. They're not really provided for very well, and they're teaching, usually about 30 children in a classroom, and I think that they're doing such a service, and they should be just absolutely appreciated and honored and helped. And I think the parents really, well, I see a lot of the parents in these classes, the fine arts classes that I'm attending, they feel like, oh, well, they're getting paid. You know, it's like this sort of American fast food mentality. Well, they're getting paid. They don't need me in there. I'm not getting paid to teach those children. You know, I kind of see that going on. And it's I guess I just don't have that same, you know, tendency to.
I think I'm older than you, but in our history of education, it was a place for children and not parents. And so the parents of many of the kids that I had, it wasn't a natural thing to go in the schools, and they stay outside and they gather, and that's also a good thing because the parents are talking to parents. But it's very difficult for them to go through the doors into the classroom, because it wasn't our tradition, and we tend to go back to those things. But you, Sarah, would have been one of the parents. One of the parents I would have been after, even if you weren't a parent of one of my students, because in a small town where you don't necessarily need to, it's easier to get to places. And I always did what I called awareness excursions. So we would go to your farm, and we would go maybe of the year, and we would see, because you're right, kids don't know where their food's coming from or how, they don't know that. Or I would invite you in, maybe even with your kids, to come with your chickens or eggs or whatever. Do a little presentation, or ask the parents to be doing that, so that the kids became more aware of, I mean, that's the autonomy in the classroom. You kind of get to do what you want. In that sense, you can invite people in. It's not, I mean, we can do that. So I would having you around.
We've recently become acquainted with some of the neighbor children, and this particular pair of children, brother and sister, I think they're 9 and 10, so they're right around my son's age, but they are public schooled, and they have a very different, you know, what I would consider kind of a typical American lifestyle. They don't have the garden or the goats or the chickens. They have dogs and cats, I think. But they have come down here when they were first coming around. They were making these comments, and I can't get one out of my head. The girl is 9 years old. She said, "I think you all must be very rich." And I said, "What on earth?" You know, because we have, my husband makes good money, but he is, you know, we're middle class. We have one income, and it is stretched out, you know.
Yeah.
And but the comment, and I said, "Why on earth would you think that?" And she said, "Well, look around." And we were outside, and she said, "Just look." She said, "You have chickens, you have goats, you have the garden, and, you know." And to her, that was wealth, and it really just stuck with me, and it made me not only more thankful for what I have, because a lot of times all I see is the work that I have to put into it to keep everything going. But that was what, you know, that was how she saw it. She saw it as riches. And I think it wasn't the material value. It was the educational value that she was so in awe of. And, you know, I really had an appreciation.
Well, but I have to interject and say, from from my perspective, growing up in West Africa,
mm-hmm.
you and the way they valued things, the things that they valued are the things that you had in abundance.
Yeah,
you know,
well,
it's kind of like when
really
a wife
it, they are.
When a wife is worth X number of goats
sustaining.
And cows.
Mm-hmm. Well, their life is sustaining. At a core level, they are security of
yeah.
food and things. You know,
and
it is,
I think about the work done by groups like Heifer International, where you know they go into a community and donate a goat.
I have
or,
seen some of
or
that.
A
I
cow
love that.
Or
mm-hmm.
you know, sheep or chickens or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then you're obligating yourself. You agree to share the offspring of those animals with other people in your community, so that it's spreading the wealth, and that within a matter of just a few generations of the animals, it can help a community that was really destitute become more self-sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it is a perspective-changing idea.
And, you know, here is something that occurs to me that as I'm listening to all three of you and something that I've experienced in my own life. Every opportunity to be with a child is a teachable moment. Every moment that I spent with my children while they were young, I was teaching them, and I was consciously aware of it. It didn't matter what we were doing, and I would take it in that vein. If we were watching a movie together, then afterwards we would discuss the meaning. That was a teachable moment. If we were out together and interacting with other people, you know, I would take all the way along, all through every age, you know, an opportunity to teach them something that I perceived they needed to know about what that situation was or what was going on there. And I think that, you know, one of the core concepts of the Arantia book is that throughout our ascension in the universe of universes, we are ever playing the role of teacher and student.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to walk in that responsibility of the teacher, no matter where you are, no matter who you find yourself with, is tremendously valuable. And that really is a great segue to our next caller. And I hope you guys will hang on with us here, because I think Sarah's waiting on the line. Sarah has been in charge of a daycare, a fairly large daycare, for many, many years. And at one of our international conferences, she did a talk that she called Joy in the Worm Bin. And, of course, she is also an
educator. Could you say that again? It was what in the worm bin?
Joy in the Worm Bin.
Okay.
It's the most remarkable and just inspiring story that she tells about how she was teaching children about the worms in the worm bin and organic. They were composting, she and a group of her children in the daycare. So hang on with us. I think we have Sarah on the line, and I'm just going to patch her through. Sarah, is it you?
Yes. Hi. Hi, Paula.
Sarah. Good morning.
Hello.
Sarah. Thank you so much for calling in.
So
we are
on with Sarah Blackstock. And we're on with another Sarah that is homeschooling her children. You've probably been listening. It's just been delightful to hear about their
yeah.
farm or their garden and their goats and chickens. And we're also on with Barbara West from British Columbia, or no, from Canada. I'm not sure if it's BC or not, Barbara. I'm sorry.
Yes, British Columbia.
Okay. So Sarah, maybe you can jump in and share with us some of your experiences with young children in the daycare.
Well, I just want to commend Sarah for what she's doing with her children in nature. I just happened to be taking a class called Nature and Childhood, and
oh.
We're reading a book called Last Child in the Woods, which you probably have heard about, by Richard Louve, Louv. And this book, if Sarah hasn't read this book, she will be mightily reinforced by what she's doing with the research that talks about the importance of children being in nature and what being in nature does for the very educational foundation for children as they observe and explore. It's essential to their foundational development. It talks about Howard Gardner in this book, who we have incorporated in our daycare center. We've incorporated his ideas into our daycare center. We have 120 kids between the ages of 5 and 11 that we work with, and we've really got an underground school. We are located on the school grounds of a public elementary school, and we happen to carve out a garden space and a huge, I don't even call it a sandbox. It's more of a sand yard. And Howard Gardner talks about 8 kinds of intelligences. Have you guys heard about this? Multiple intelligences?
Yes. Oh, I have.
Yeah.
I think that's such an important topic.
Very yes, true. And we, because we can formulate our own curriculum. Nobody tells us what to do because we're private, nonprofit. So the school district doesn't tell us what to do. What we do is we've got 15 to 20 teachers, and almost half of them are men, which is fantastic. So we can look, and what we have done over the past 25 years of my involvement with this is we've looked at the children and what the children like to do. And so we have been able to offer the 8, we've been able to offer activities and programs for the 8 kinds of intelligences. Schools teach to the linguistic intelligence, which is the word smart, and the logical mathematical intelligence, which is the number reasoning smart, okay? Basically, that's what they teach to. And the other 6 intelligences are spatial intelligence, which is the picture smart. Those are the ones that, you know, like to do art. The bodily kinesthetic intelligence, body smart, the ones that like to move, the sports kids, the dance kids. Musical intelligence, which is the music smart. Interpersonal intelligence, which is the people smart. These are the managers of the world. These are the ones that are walking around. They know what everybody's doing, okay? And then there's intrapersonal intelligence, which is the self-smart, the kids that know themselves, the ones that like to be by themselves a lot, that like to journal. And the 8th intelligence is nature smart, the naturalist intelligence. And wow. In this book, Last Child in the Woods, it's supported by all kinds of research about what being in nature does for children. It creates the values of enjoyment of solitude and the simple pleasures of nature. It heightens the senses of, I'm preaching to the choir here, but feeling, touching, seeing, smelling, hearing. The research shows that children that have had greater exposure to nature have heightened senses. They learn about the life cycles, as Sarah was talking about, birth, death, seasons, insects, and how things grow and when they die. Children notice the patterns in their surroundings more, because that's something that you notice in nature. They have collections of whatever it is, snake skins and rocks and, dead beetles. And I see all of this
in the daycare. Oh, yes, they do.
Okay? I see all of this in the daycare. And they organize. This helps them organize their knowledge. It helps categorize for their world. They experience the world directly. It's not secondhand experience. So when these kids are in their sand area, kids from the ages of 5 all the way up to 11, they dig, they put water in, they see how water flows downhill. They create the biggest mountain they can. They dig down as far as they can to get the Indian clay, which is, of course, one of the great things to discover is the Indian clay. And they learn about islands and peninsulas. Right there. They're not learning off from dittos. They're learning right there with their hands in the water, and yes, they get muddy. And fortunately, our parents don't care that much, you know, if the kids get a little dirty. So another thing that being in nature does, and you know this, Sarah, is it reduces stress. The research shows that children who have greater exposure to nature, it bolsters their resilience against adversity, and it helps them relax. It clears their mind, and they get more exercise. So those are just some of the few things that, you know, nature does for us. And this is a movement that is beginning to really take hold as people are very concerned about how disconnected children are because of they're plugged in. They're
exactly.
being electrified.
Exactly.
I think this is so great that we're talking about this topic right now because, you know, I really was hoping that we would have the opportunity or an appropriate segue to talk about, as Urantia book readers, what we think that education should be, given all the additional information that we have about what the universe, the long-term universe perspective is, and the Edenic model that wasn't really able to flourish as much as it should have. How can we interject more of those values into our current culture and lifestyle?
Yes, and in the Edenic model, didn't they devote, wasn't the day divided up into, I believe, three sections or segments? There was a socialization, a study. Help me remember. I haven't read that for a long time. The day was divided up into three parts. Study, socialization.
Paula, do you have an opportunity to search that?
I could, if I had.
Anyway,
if I had keywords.
Let me bring up something else that I've found that the Urantia book really highlights. Speaking of education. If we look at the education of Jesus as a young child, and I did kind of a little study on how much he was in nature. Of course, in those days, 2,000 years ago, it was a lot easier. But he was always around animals, like you're doing, Sarah. He not only played in the garden, but when he was around 8 years old, his mother taught him how to take care of the vines and the flowers around the garden wall. When he was about 4 years old, he spent 2 months on a farm. And then periodically, I think all the way through his early teens, he went to a farm and he got to see, you know, animals born and animals die and maybe even, you know, perhaps slaughtered. I don't know quite what they did. They don't go into detail on that. His father took him on walks up the hills where he could have a 360-degree view of the whole area there. His mother provided shallow boxes of sand, and Jesus and his friends worked out maps and practiced writing. He practiced writing in these sand boxes in three languages. So look what we do with our kids today. We give them pencils, which removes them from feeling what numbers and letters feel like. And in our daycare center, in our junior kindergarten program, we have sand boxes, and the children draw the letters with their fingers before they're given a pencil. And they can feel it. They can feel what the letters feel like.
That's great.
And then, you know, it goes on. Jesus played with blocks in the sand. He walked with his father from village to village. They rode, you know, their donkey. He studied the stars by night. And so, I mean, he had such a direct contact with nature. He played with clay. He went on fishing excursions. He helped with harvesting the grain on the farm. So
I had remembered that had stuck out to me when I've only read through the Jesus papers one time, but it stuck out to me. There was one place where it said that he had always wished that they had had more of a farm.
Yes, mm, yes.
Something to that degree. It was just like a simple statement, but
yeah.
Well, he wanted to move the family onto a farm, and was planning to do so, and then their finances really fell apart,
yes.
And he wasn't able to do that, and it was something he really regretted.
Yes, that was what I was remembering.
Right.
Yeah, he was able to visit his uncle's farm, though.
Right.
I think they visited at least once a year. Where he had, but his mother, you know, his family had a cow. They at least had a cow,
yeah.
That Rand's book talks about, and
mm-hmm.
chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And so he got that experience. And then, you know, they grew probably all of their vegetables. I mean, everybody did in those days.
Can I just interject something here?
Of course.
These, all those stories that you're talking about, Sarah, are... My children heard those stories from, you know, infancy up. Their dad told a lot of Jesus stories, so that
yeah.
Jesus became a real person and had this mm. extraordinary life. So if you talked about, mm. you know, going to his uncle's farm or, you know, all the way up to being a camel train leader. I mean, those
yeah.
are amazing
yeah.
stories. He becomes the real man, and he can be your real friend. And so each of those little things about gazing at the stars and studying the flowers, each of those is a nighttime story to tell
yes.
your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it just grows a part of them, and they begin to, you know, be able to have this conversation with a real person that, you know,
yes.
as they grow.
A person
so.
They really know.
And that they mm-hmm. can relate to, because they themselves
mm-hmm. yes.
know how wonderful it is to look at the stars and follow the moon and feel the sun and the wind
mm-hmm.
and, you know, just experience nature in all of its glory. And its nature is not always pretty. You know, things
mm-hmm.
die. And we used to have rats, you know, pet rats at our daycare center. Yeah, they're intelligent and they're clean. And if you forget about the tail, you know, you can really appreciate them. But the reason that I liked having rats as pets is because they had a short lifespan, about 3 years, and then they would die. And for some children, this was their first experience with death. And I remember when a rat would die, and, you know, hopefully it would still be kind of warm, but even if it wasn't, you know, they usually died of old age. If it wasn't, then... So anyway, the children would sit around in a circle, and they always wanted to have kind of a ceremony because this rat is dead. And they would pass the dead rat wrapped in a cloth so that, you know, people wouldn't say, ew. They'd pass it around in a circle, and you could just see the children looking at this dead rat. And for the first time in their life, getting a feeling for what dead is, and yet appreciating that yesterday it was alive.
Mm.
And remembering, you know, what it was like.
Mm.
It's good to have things that die, because that's part of life, and so death isn't such a big shock, and that's part of nature.
Right.
You know.
And
so
my children really appreciated watching things be born. That
yeah.
was just, there again is another amazing thing for a children to witness, a dog having puppies or...
Oh.
Or,
yeah. Oh,
livestock
yeah.
or whatever, you know, the birth cycle. It's really amazing. And the pregnancy even, you know,
mm-hmm.
which is another, you know, when mom is pregnant and now there's a baby. It's an
yeah,
amazing
and even
thing.
Before that, even the mating.
yeah.
I remember my first, you know, questions about sex was seeing two dogs in the backyard stuck together.
Me too.
Six
that
years
was how
old,
I
you
learned.
Too. Yeah, and they seemed
is.
Very uncomfortable. And I said, "What's the problem? What is the problem? Why can't you help them?" And my
yeah.
mother said, "I'll tell you later
trouble.
About it." they're in big trouble.
My own children came running in, just absolutely panic stricken
yeah.
because
yeah.
of that, and they. They
I know.
Oh boy.
Let's help
my
them.
Mother. My grandfather used to tell this story about my mother. She grew up on a farm,
mm.
and she comes running in to a social gathering of my grandfather and some of his fellow farmers, and she says, Daddy, you've just got to come out here right now. That rooster is really molesting those hens.
Oh, my goodness.
You've got to come out and stop it right now, Daddy.
It looks horrible. It really does.
Yeah.
Well, you do feel sorry for the hen.
Yeah.
Well, Sarah, can we get you the story about the joy in the worm bin?
I actually wish I had it in front of me because it's so fun. So what we did is we decided to do an experiment at the daycare center with a worm bin. And worms eat my garbage. Worms Eat Our Garbage, I think, is the book I used from, I think it's Jim McNally that wrote that book. So we followed his outline of setting up a worm bin. And dirt and newspapers and in a box and lots of worms and then you start feeding them garbage. And
organic garbage.
Hopefully. I'm not sure. This was, maybe 8 or 9 years ago, so I'm not sure that we were doing organic as much as we are now at the daycare with our snacks, but... Anyway, but vegetable garbage, not, meat and stuff like that. So we developed a whole ecosystem with these worms, and the children became quite involved in vermiculture, I think it's called. And so they wanted to help so much that they started overfeeding them. And that created a terrible smell, so we kind of had to clean that up and start over again. And they wanted to be sure that they had plenty of water, so they almost drowned them in trying to serve them. And so out of this vermiculture, I came up with, eight or nine different principles of service, and I can't remember them right now because I don't have them in front of me. But once again, it was right there in front of us, and we could observe it, and the children learned so much from it. And then you can take the droppings. It's not really droppings, but what the worms give out, and put them on the plants to fertilize the plants.
Right.
But that isn't quite, what the talk on joy in the worm bin was, Paula. I'd have to have it in front of me to do better than that.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of it, Paula?
I just remember that I thoroughly enjoyed it, and the eight different points that of service that you came up with just from a worm bin. And, I at one point had to revive them because they got too dry or something. I don't remember now.
Right, and they almost drowned them. Yeah, so don't serve too much. I think that was one of the principles of service. Don't serve too much.
Yeah,
but
even
as far as
there can even be too much of a good thing.
And I do think that sometimes we as parents bring our own experience into the moment of, maybe, I don't know if you want to call it neuroses, but we don't want them to get dirty or, obviously your parents don't care, which is so wonderful because children really do love to dig in up to the elbows. And today I remember
I was always dirty. I mean,
my
I was
children
always
are so dirty.
And I remember my mom at one point saying, I just don't know how, I just don't know what we're going to do with you when you get older. I mean, how are you ever going to sort of like turn into a lady?
Well, in this book, Last Child in the Woods, the author, Louvre, gave some examples of people that have really contributed in our society and how connected with nature they were. For example, Jane Goodall, the chimpanzee woman, at 2 years of age, slept with earthworms under her pillow. And Thomas Edison was found when he was a child sitting in a box of straw. And he explained, I saw baby chickens come out of the egg.
Well, and, you know, and getting a little closer to home, I don't know how many of you know about William Sadler's childhood, but it's really quite a remarkable story. You know, he had a younger sibling that had died at an early age, and his mother became really quite overprotective, maybe even a little paranoid about letting him go to school in the public school system. And so he was completely homeschooled and almost completely self-schooled or self-taught. And
wow.
When you look at what he accomplished educationally during his lifetime, I mean, I think he might go down in history as having been one of the most widely and diversely expert educated in I can't remember now how many different subjects, but the man, you know, graduated sort of magna cum laude from university and in several different subjects, and then at one point decided to go back and become a doctor, you know, later in life. I mean, not like right out of high school kind of thing, or not right out of right at like the age of 18 or 20. I think it was he and Lena were quite a bit older when they decided to go to medical school. But I find that to be a really interesting story, in just unique educational experiences.
It touches on something that has been a thread throughout every one of these interviews that we've done, Crystalyn, with Roy Healy, John Krieger, Charles Olivier, and now with these wonderful ladies, and that is that.
Well, and Andre Rodatis, Barb Nunes.
We're called to create a hunger in children for knowledge, and to keep that hunger, keep that appetite whetted. You know what I mean? Because obviously we've talked to people who have taught all age groups now, and that hunger can be, you know, lulled into a place of complacency or just dumbed down to absolute sheer boredom, which is probably the worst thing that can happen to a child. My own son dropped out in the 12th grade because he could not stand another minute. He was so bored. And, of course, he went on to get his GED and now he's getting his master's at the Heron School in the Purdue complex right now, which is amazing. He's 33. But his appetite for knowledge wasn't killed, but it could have been. And so it just shows that, you know, the task is to keep their appetite whetted for knowledge and for learning, and to keep their interest going. And as Sarah Blackstock has said many times, to kindle their fire and to kindle their desire to know spiritually and in every other way. So I think that's just an interesting thread. I just wanted to throw that out there. That's a pattern that we've seen in all of these interviews now. The challenge is keeping their interest and keeping their appetite whetted for knowledge.
Well, and it was interesting to hear what you were saying, Barb, about the rhythm of language and the sort of harmony of reading more advanced literature to young children. And
mm-hmm.
not knowing that at the time, I mean, I didn't know it anyway, but we, growing up in the bush, we didn't have very much in the way of children's literature, and my dad said we exhausted the possibilities of the few children's books and world book encyclopedias and stuff that we had by the time we were about 3 and 5. And so he started reading the adult literature that he had in the house. That was before we went off to boarding school, and you know, we were used to listening to fairly advanced literature by the time we would have been first graders. And I just remember the intensity with which I had to learn to read when I was being taught reading in school. It wasn't to get through the Dick and Jane books. It was for me to be able to catch up to where my dad and brother were back in the village in the Tolkien trilogy. You know, I had to be able to read at a 9th or 10th grade level by the time I was 7 in order to keep up with where they were in the books, because, you know, I had missed out on a year of reading that I had to catch up on before I would get home for the holiday. And so, you know, my friends were reading other kids' books, and I was just, like, motoring through, you know, Tolkien with a dictionary when necessary. And it reminds me of what you were saying about your kids reading the Urantia book with a dictionary at early ages. And I guess, no, that was one of my conversations with Ann Garner and her daughter, who started study group in elementary school because she was just so passionate about reading the Urantia book for herself. And my own niece, who wasn't allowed to go to the children's study group until her little brother could read, and she was already reading at a much more advanced level by the age of 6 or 7, and my brother found her sneaking the Urantia book off the shelf and reading it because she couldn't go to study group yet. And he didn't really want to dissuade her. He thought it was kind of cool that she thought she had to sneak it, you know, off in the corner to read secretly. And he said, you know, if you come along any words that you don't understand, or if there's anything you can't quite get, you know, you can feel free to ask me. And she looks up at him and rolls her eyes and says, "Dad, I'm 7.
Oh, goodness.
So I think that, you know, just maybe it's a more modern cultural thing, but I think we've really undersold or had lower expectations of what we thought kids could do at much earlier ages. And now they're, if I'm right, they're discovering that one of the best times for kids to learn to read are the, you know, very early ages, where they're, like, much younger than what we thought, that they learn to see an entire word and comprehend its meaning at the same time that they're learning to speak. Do you know anything about that, Sarah or Barbara?
Can you hear me?
I would just want to add that there's a bit of a problem with people wanting to teach their kids to read. And I think listening to good literature and hearing the rhythm of the language prepares them for learning to read when they're ready. And those other things about learning to talk to people and understand people and learning perspective taking and art, music, drama, building worm bins, all of those things, being in nature, are the real critical things. And that the actual teaching, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true with all children. Sarah, what
do you
know,
think? I would agree. Can you guys hear me now?
Sure. Yeah.
Oh, good. I don't know what happened, but I'm back. This is Sarah Blackstock. My understanding of some of the research has to do with the ability of the child whether they can see words at a very early age. Once again, if we think about the eight kinds of intelligences, there are children who have the linguistic intelligence, and they are able to decipher words very, very early. And see whole words and even sound them out. And there are other children that this is just so abstract to that they won't begin to hook in with that ability until maybe third grade, and this can be especially true for boys. And they need more original experience with life first before the word makes sense to them. But what you're saying is so true. Reading stories, the rhythm of the stories as you're driving along the road. I have a two-year-old granddaughter, and right now when we go for a ride, I point out the stop sign. And I say, see that? S-T-O-P, stop. And I kind of get a little song going and a rhythm going. So while you're driving with your kids, you know, there's all kinds of words out there. So it's teaching them to read, but it's not sitting them down in front of a paper or a book or those cute little Einstein cards. And I tried that, and she knocked them out of my hands. You know, it just had no relevance to her at all. Okay, put these back on the shelf. Let's go to the worm bin.
Let's go to the worm bin.
Could I just say one more thing? I know we're almost out of time here, but you talked about how we're all parents and teachers and individuals, you know, we're given the opportunity to help others in all kinds of ways. And I really want to get back to that, the morality that we need to begin with very early in life, not only with our own children, but with others. And it says here on page 193, morality can never be advanced by law or by force. It is a personal free will matter and must be disseminated by the contagion of the contact of morally fragrant persons with those who are less morally responsive. So I'd just like to be a morally fragrant person. And I want to just say that my children have been my most important work, like you said, Sarah. And they have also been my greatest resource and still are. So.
And they still are.
Yes.
They are our greatest teachers, too.
Yes.
Because
just
as Sarah Blackstock just pointed out, they will let you know what they need. If they don't want it, the Einstein cards, they'll let you know that. And we can be responsive to their needs by listening to their cues, too, and you know, following their innate intelligence as well, and not trying to force them to do something that they're not at all interested in. Although obviously you do have to teach children fundamentals, and that's important, you know. But still, they become our greatest teachers too.
Yes.
Well, and speaking of the master and the things that he had to teach us about learning, and you know, sort of using his life as a cue. I was always really moved by the decisions that he made, even early in life, about his own education, and that he chose to stay with his family instead of going off to the synagogue schools in Jerusalem to study with the great religious teachers of his day. And that he took a great deal of time and consideration and thought in with that decision. And that this was a decision that his parents let him make for himself at that point in his life. That really moved me as a child or as a young person, that he was allowed to struggle with that decision for himself. And it wasn't superimposed on him by his parents. And what? How old was he then? 10 or 12? But just that also seems like an important. I mean, there's a reason that they included that story
in his biography.
There's something just because of I have the little bit of like a messianic Judaism understanding is part of that is the Jewish culture where they consider young men to be men at that age of the bar mitzvah.
About 13.
Yeah, they actually consider them to be men at that age. So I think there's kind of a Jewish mentality of that, you know, that kind of allowing that maturity to come, that, you know, that respect for the adulthood to come much earlier than, say, modern American culture, which we think is
And they celebrate milestones of maturity, too, which is, you know, the Urantia book really holds up the Jewish parenting and culture in that way as being exemplary for, for young people.
And it absolutely was top-notch during his time, you know, the time of the incarnation. It was definitely the very best place he could have been.
Yep. And I think those celebrations of milestones are huge. You know, I know, Sarah, you've talked about this a lot in daycare and how you celebrate certain milestones with children. And I think that's just a rite of passage, and it's something that's missing largely in Western culture, and it's kind of sad for me that it doesn't happen more, that we don't celebrate with our children, you know, and really accentuate their coming into adulthood or various milestones. It's just important, I think.
Yeah, let me share one milestone that we acknowledge is our daycare goes up through fifth grade, and then the kids go on to middle school, sixth grade. And there we offer a volunteer program. And so that milestone is, for the ones that are interested, now you get to become the servers of the younger children. And so they will come over from middle school to the daycare and mop up the overflowed toilets and empty the trash and sharpen the pencils and help the younger children, whereas they used to be one of the younger children. So you can see the whole different demeanor that they take on when now they are the helpers of the younger children. It's pretty cool.
One of our previous guests that we've had on our program, Al Lockett, who has, you know, started a really dramatic program in the South where kids teach other kids. Families are far more involved in the whole educational experience, especially in special needs areas, and where older kids are teaching younger kids. And this is really right out of the Urantia book ideals for universe education, that we're really not considered to have learned or not credited with having learned something until we've successfully taught it to someone coming up right below us.
Yes.
I wanted to give a shout out to him today. He was going to try to call in, but he actually was having a grand opening of a new center, a new learning center. And so I wanted to just congratulate Al on that and say we wish you could have been with us today, but we're looking forward to having you with us again, and we hope everything goes really well for you today. So
how can we get a hold of him? Do you have a website for him, or maybe I can get that later?
I can get it to you later. I don't have it on my fingertips right now.
Yeah, I would love to know more about what he's doing.
He does have a website, and I can't remember it right offhand, but I'll see if I can find it for you, Sarah.
Okay, thank
you,
Paula.
Well, we're once again down to less than 6 minutes left on our program, and it always amazes me how fast this 2 hours goes when we're talking about things that we're passionate about. But
I want to point out before you say anything else that there are two things that are tremendously of value in the Urantia book in terms of childhood education that they hold up several times, and one is, and we've spoken about them, But one is that children are provided an opportunity to learn by doing, and they even say that that is throughout the universe career for all of us. We are provided an opportunity as beings, as ascended beings in the universe of universes, to learn by doing. I think that's
yes.
so critical. And then the other one is that older children are almost always incorporated to teach younger children. And, you know, I find that younger children are just naturally interested in what the next, you know, maybe a child 5 years older than them is doing. You know,
yes.
they have this natural interest and respect for an older child. So I think those are, for young childhood education, those are just two really important factors that the Urantia book holds up.
Yes, yeah.
I found Al's website. It's learningfortoday.com, and the letter, the number four instead of
okay.
the word.
Learningfortoday.com. Thank you.
And one of the other things that I'd like to end up with today, one of the purposes for this program was in response to Sarah Lancaster's request for educational materials for someone who is homeschooling that can interject Urantia ideals and Urantian educational suggestions, and for materials that either parents or teachers or ministers have developed for kids in the movement around the country and around the world. We're kind of putting a request out there for you to let us know of any materials, either books or illustrations or learning materials that would be of use to parents.
Where do we send them?
Where do you send them? Well,
yeah.
you can send them to us here through the Cosmic Citizen. And I can give you, Paula, you want to give out your address for that? Or you can just email us at either one of our go ahead.
ubooksrus@aol.com. ubooksrus@aol.com.
Okay. And let me just put out there that the Unity Church has an excellent, excellent curriculum for children. And that they are based on metaphorical teaching, which children identify with right away. So that's something to check out. Thank you for this. That's helpful.
The Unity Church has a actual school curriculum?
They have in their Sunday
school. Or is
school,
it just a spiritual
yes,
course?
They have many. They have many, many books. So if you go to a Unity Church and look through their books, Unity Center, if you go to a Unity Center, look through their books, you'll see some excellent ideas.
Okay.
And I want to just reiterate some of the books that our current guests have authored or that other Urantia book readers have authored. Barb, you mentioned Marvin Gowron's book on family council.
That was
it's called Family Meetings.
Family Meetings.
Meeting. I don't know if you can get it anymore.
Robert
anyway.
Slagle wrote that. Robert Slagle.
Okay, right.
Marvin Gowron, Robert Slagle on the Family Meeting
right.
Handbook.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, we might be able
and
to
even
get a
if it's of... Even if it's out of print, Sarah, we can probably get a copy for you from Marvin or from Bob. And there was a book that was written more of a novel or a children's storybook by, wasn't it Julia Fenderson?
On the Way, the Joshua story?
Pardon me?
The Joshua Ben Joseph
story?
I can't remember who wrote that.
There was another book called David and Ruth.
Love story, yes.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a great one.
It's a wonderful story.
Yeah.
And I would like to highly recommend The Last Child in the Woods, the one that I was referring to about the importance of nature education for children. I think
that's
foundational.
That's going to go right in my wish list.
good.
David Zebedee and Ruth was Helena Sprigg.
Right.
Oh, that's a one, and that's really a great book. And if any of our listeners today or people who listen to this show in our archives would send us a list of books or materials that you've used. I know that LaRuth Tiao in Hawaii has put together a lot of materials for her own kids and her grandchildren. They weren't books that she had published or put out to the community at large, but I'm putting a shout out to LaRuth that she considers sharing some of those with us. And that one of the purposes for this series has been that it's been brought up that we really need to put together an educational symposium in the next year. We'd like to call out to all parents, homeschoolers, and professional educators who are interested in coming together for an educational symposium. And
yes,
we would invite you all to participate in that, and we'll keep you posted.
Yes, I would be interested
just
in that.
Another
we're out
book
of time.
Is-
We're out of time. We're off the air now. So we want to thank our guests.
And
we can,
if you want to get that recommendation in, this will be heard by anybody who listens to the archive. So go ahead and finish your thought, and then we can close.
Okay, just a book called The Last Explorer by Simon Nash. It's a story of Sir Hubert Wilkins, and he was one of the forum for Sadler, and it's a world history.
Mm.
I mean, really, it is. It should
really
be in the history books.
See, this
yes,
is what I am
book
more specifically looking for, as my children are in the grade school ages, is the supplementation for not only history, but more importantly, science.
Yes.
And the Christian curriculums are just a mess with that, you know, the creationist teachings. And I'm always tossing between, you know, secular and Christian, and it just neither is appropriate for
right
me anymore. And I'm really looking for books that contain the Urantia science and history information, just as supplementation, if nothing else.
And that
wow
are written for that are written with education and children and a curriculum in mind. We had a wonderful letter this week after our guest speaker, Charles Olivier, last week, who was very inspired to get working on some of these curriculum ideas. So we really invite all of the professional educators in our movement to participate in this with us, because I think the time has come that more and more people are interested in spreading not just the religious teachings, but the entire cultural teachings of the Urantia book to our next generations.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Barbara. That I will definitely go order that book.
Mm-hmm. Order that book. Wait till you read it. Great.
And the one you shared too, Sarah, The Last Child in the Woods, those are two on my list now. So
Good.
And ladies, wow, what a delight to speak to you all today. I just thoroughly enjoyed this conversation. So thank you so much.
So did I.
Thank you for
having
me.
And I'm so grateful to those of you who came on board at, you know, the 11th hour. we had floods in the Northeast and burning homes and prairies in the Southwest. That affected some of the speakers we had planned to come on today, and some of you just came in and filled in on the last minute. We're really grateful to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the privilege.
I just love the passion for this topic that
yes,
is coming from all of our guests and our listeners. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank
yes
you.
Thank
bye-bye.
Hope to talk.
Have a wonderful week.
Yes.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Next week.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.